Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together, we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. Law Talk, that is us. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Delighted to be with you. For the next hour, our job, answer legal questions, dispense legal advice, try to help you navigate your way through that thicket of laws and rules and regulations that's out there, seemingly waiting to ensnare any one of us. So how do we do that? First of all, this program works best if you allow us to help you by giving us a call, 860-522-WTIC, 860-522-9842. Let us know your legal problem, your legal issue, your legal comment. We'll react to it, see if we can't give you some information that's going to be helpful going forward. In the meantime, though, we've got a bunch of recent cases in Connecticut courts, federal and state, that we're going to take a look at. They're carefully curated, and each one of them has a point that is going to be helpful or valuable. It's a takeaway that we're going to share with you. So, without further ado, let me tell you a little bit about the lineup today. And bear in mind, we're here for an hour, and if you're thinking about giving us a call with your legal issue, give us a call a little bit earlier rather than a little bit later. It'll give us a little more time to address your matter, give you the attention that you're entitled to, and see if we can't help you out. When you allow us to help you, you're helping a lot of other folks that have an interest in that exact same issue, okay? Once again, those phone numbers, 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. Okay, first thing up, legal word of the day, mandamus. Wow, what is all that about? Well, we'll tell you. What happened when Mayor Mark downstate tried to kill a development project which had already been through the necessary municipal board approval process? So we'll find out exactly how that worked out. The takeaway is going to be the word mandamus, and you'll see how this may be of some interest to you, not just if you're a developer, but even on a much smaller scale. If you want to put up a garage in your backyard and you run into some kind of nefarious problem of a nature like this. We're going to follow that one up with the legal concept of the day. First, we did the legal word. Now we're going to do the legal concept. That's going to be comparative negligence. We're going to take a look at a recent case that is going to address the question, can both parties be responsible for the collision? Well, we'll see what the judge said, and we'll see what we can learn from that. Following that, getting into the next part of the show, probably around the bottom of the half hour after news, weather, etc., the legal rule of the day. It's called the mailbox rule. What the heck is that? Well, we'll find out. And it's a very unusual case that's going to explain it. It's a case from the New Haven Housing Court. It's an eviction case involving possession of a rooftop. That's right, a rooftop. So we'll visit the mailbox rule. And then finally, if we have time and we get to it, just a really weird case about a lawyer who loans money to a client. Okay, so the red flags are going off already. Yeah, you're exactly right. The client did not repay the loan. The lawyer eventually forgives the debt in writing. Then something happens. The lawyer changes his mind and he sues the client to collect the debt anyway. All kinds of weirdness in this story. A couple of really good takeaways, not only for those of you dealing with lawyers, but for you lawyers out there listening also. Everybody got into trouble on this case. So that's the lineup for today. Once again, our phone number is 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. Okay, first case up. Remember, word of the day is mandamus. What is all that? Well, the word technically means a writ of mandamus. Writ of mandamus is an order from the court compelling a government official to do something that they're supposed to do. So let's take a look at this case that comes out of the Milford Superior Court, okay? The plaintiff is an LLC, and we don't need to know its name here, and it's going to develop a residential community off a street in Shelton. There are already sewers in the street, but they need the permission of the local water pollution control authority in order to tie into that sewer so that they can go ahead and use it for the residential apartment complex that they're going to build. So they've had several hearings in front of the water pollution control authority, and the water pollution control authority, as it often does, sends the proposal off to its consulting engineers for review, and the consulting engineers send back their report. By the way, if you happen to be a developer, guess who is going to end up having to pay for the town's consulting engineers? And you're not exactly going to be paying wholesale prices either. Well, anyway, the board goes ahead and it approves the application to tie into the sewer. Well, then there's a problem. They go to get the permit and they can't seem to get the permit signed. Somebody finally says that, well, the mayor has a problem with this. Now, according to a footnote that the judge provided here, Mayor Mark, last name omitted, has been the mayor of the city of Shelton for something like 33 years, okay? So he's obviously quite comfortable in power and probably quite willing to do whatever he thinks he wants to do. So the developer hears, hey, the mayor's got a problem with this. The mayor, by the way, happens to be the supervisor of the official who has the legal authority to sign the approvals to tie into the sanitary sewer. So the developers go to see the mayor, and the mayor says, well, you know, I really don't want to see apartments on that street there. The density is a little bit too great. I think that the town would best be served by something else. Now, remember that this is a project that's already gone through all the approvals, and so they need an excuse. And they say that, well, we didn't really grant you an approval. What we did was the motion was to accept your application. And there it sits, accepted, but not approved. Now, the developer has a lot of money tied up in this project. They had already started excavating. There's a big hole in the ground and nothing else because they can't get the building permit they need without the permission to tie into the sewer. So off to court we go. The developer seeks what's called a writ of mandamus. So let's talk a little bit about that, and then we'll see exactly what happened in this case, okay? First of all, the writ of mandamus is an unusual type of thing. It is not done commonly, and the court says it is only to be granted sparingly. Court says it's an extraordinary remedy available in limited circumstances, limited purposes. Now, if the public official against whom this writ is aimed is engaging in an activity with discretionary judgment, you're never going to get it. However, if what they're doing is basically what's called a ministerial act, where there's no discretion involved and they refuse to do it, the case is ripe for a mandamus. So as the court said here, a writ of mandamus will lie only to direct performance of a ministerial act, which requires no exercise of judgment or discretion. So in this case here, the mayor and his crew said, well, no, this is just accepted. It wasn't approved. They went back and showed the developer went back and showed that in other hearings, the two terms were used interchangeably. The judge concludes this is a distinction without a difference. And then the actual members of the Water Pollution Control Authority said that they understood at the time of the vote that the motion was for a final approval, not to accept this. Long story short, the judge grants the writ of mandamus. The authority acting through its director is ordered to perform its official public duty to carry out the vote granting final approval to the application, including signing off on the plaintiff's building permit, which they hadn't even asked for, but the judge jumped right ahead, anticipating further problems. And just to make it clear how strongly the judge felt about this, he said this is supposed to be completed no later than 3 p.m. on Friday, August 23rd. You know when the decision issued? August the 22nd. That's right. Gave him 24 hours to do it. No stay pending appeal, no other nonsense of that nature. The long story short, and the takeaway here, is that if you run into a similar situation, whether you're a developer, as was the case here, or whether you're an everyday folk like the rest of us that maybe wants to build a garage in your backyard and you run into hassles like this, check with your lawyer, because a writ of mandamus may very well be something that's going to be a valuable tool in your legal toolbox. We'll be back with more of Law Talk after this. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. This is WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net where you can listen live by simply clicking on the box, an audio radio station. Oh yeah, Ventura Highway America taking us back here and bumping us into the next segment on Law Talk, WTIC News Talk 1080, an Odyssey radio station. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We're happy to help you with your legal calls, your legal inquiries. Susan from Simsbury called and did not want to go on the air, but wanted some help. So let me describe the issue as I understand it and see if we can't give you a couple of points. From what I understand, Susan said that her favorite aunt that she was very, very close to passed away, and that contrary to Susan's expectations and contrary to what she had been told, the aunt did not leave her a bequest in the will. Susan says that she's very interested in challenging the will, but she wants to know what kind of information the lawyer is going to want and how that process generally unfolds. So we're going to touch on that for a minute, and we're also going to use it as an opportunity to remind you, if you've got questions concerning legal matters, they don't have to be related to the topics we have pre-selected. We are happy to hear from you anyway, just like we did from Susan in Simsbury. The phone number, 860-522-WTIC, that is 860-522-9842. So, Susan, first of all, the most important question is, what happens if you challenge the will and are successful in knocking it out? Now, what does that mean? Here's what it means. Is there a previous will? Because what happens here, and this sounds like it's a little bit of lawyer gobbledygook, but it's the phrase. It's called dependent relative revocation. When your aunt signed that will that's in front of the probate court, the signing of that will revoked her previous will, if any. And so if you are successful in challenging the will that's before the court, that means that the revocation was unsuccessful also, and that the previous will springs to life. Now, why does it matter? Well, is there a previous will? And if so, are you involved in it? Are you a beneficiary of the previous will? If there's no previous will, then your aunt's estate is going to be disposed of by what's called the laws of intestate succession. Another big phrase there means no will. Testate means having a will. Intestate means no will. So what does that mean? Closest living relatives, next of kin. Now, you mentioned that you are a niece, okay? If there are any children, parents, or even siblings of your aunt, the deceased cherished aunt, your favorite aunt, they're going to inherit before you do. If your aunt died without a previous will, unless you are next of kin, you're not going to inherit. And it doesn't matter if there's one or there's five or seven that are in the class ahead of you, they will share equally among themselves before anything goes to you. Okay? So the lawyer that you're going to talk to about this is likely to ask you that question right up front. And you have to find out. If you don't know if there's a previous will or not, there are ways that that can be pursued. The lawyer can help you with that. Now, on the challenge, there's only four grounds that you can challenge a will on. And so we'll just touch on these briefly, and then we're going to get to the next question that we had already planned out here. One of them is that the document doesn't comply with Connecticut law. That's extremely rare. That would be malpractice on the part of the lawyer that drafted the will. Well, you say the will was drafted in Florida because she lived there for 6 months and a day for tax reasons. It's okay. Florida requirements as far as witnessing and formalities may differ, but if the will is valid under the law of the state where it was executed, then Connecticut is going to honor it, okay? It's called the full faith and credit provision of the U.S. Constitution. So that's ground number one, and we seldom see that. Other grounds that are more popular, testamentary capacity. You have to prove that your aunt's testamentary capacity was so low that she couldn't have made a valid will. And it's a very low standard, okay? You can actually be conserved and you can still have a capacity to make a valid will. What it involves, number one, did you know that the document you were signing was a will? Yeah, okay. That's point number one. Point number two, do you know who your next of kin were, what your family consists of? If you can say that, you're two-thirds of the way there. And the final one is, do you know what your estate consisted of just in general terms? If you know if you owned a house or not, if you think you own the Brooklyn Bridge, you're probably in trouble. But that's it. And you can have delusions. You can have all kinds of other emotional or behavioral challenges. It's a very low standard to make a valid will. The last ground is undue influence, and that means that the document is the product of influence exerted by another person to such a great extent that the will is the end result of that influence and is not the actual wishes of the person signing it. It's the fourth ground of fraud, and that's very uncommon also. So Susan and Simsbury, that's the story. Any of the rest of you like to have us help you out with a question? The number is once again, 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. Okay, we're going to take a trip here to a Walgreens parking lot and a car accident between Georgia and between Scott. And this is going to lead us into the second topic, our legal concept of the day, comparative negligence. And if we have to put a subtopic in it, it is, well, can both parties be the cause of the accident? So here's what happened, okay? Georgia is driving into the parking lot at the Walgreens, and she wants to get a prescription filled for her young son. So it's pretty crowded. She's looking around, and Scott is driving a pickup truck that's owned by his employer, Empire Paving. And so he's looking for a way to get out. He makes a left turn in front of her into her lane, and the left front of George's car collides with the left front fender to the rear of the wheel well with Scott's Toyota pickup truck. And so Georgia has a claim for personal injuries and property damage. Scott, however, his company sues for the damage to the pickup truck. So this is a case that gets tried, and we won't go too far into the details, but we'll tell you some major points, and then we'll tell you why it is that we think this is a good thing for you to know. The judge is the arbiter of fact, and the judge weighs the credibility of the parties. The judge determined that they were each 50% liable for the accident. Okay. Now, Connecticut is what's called a comparative negligence state. Hence, the legal concept of the day, comparative negligence. That means that if my case is worth X dollars, but I am, say, 30% responsible for the accident, then the court is going to award me X dollars reduced by 30%. Okay. And the same holds true on a counterclaim, which is exactly what we had here. So the judge basically listened to both sides, listened to the testimony. There was one expert witness, and the only thing that the expert did was to confirm the cost of the body work that needed to be done on Scott's Toyota pickup truck. So the judge basically awarded each of them 50% of their claim. And the moral of the story is, even if there is an accident and you are partially responsible for it, it doesn't mean you're not going to collect. But 50% means you're going to get half of what it's worth. 49.9% means you are SOL, meaning sadly out of luck, because it's comparative negligence up to that point. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to be back with more Law Talk after that. We are here to provide you information, answer your questions, and do whatever we can to help you figure out how to get through this legal world in which we live. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we'll be back with you after the news, the weather, etc., and after you're right up until 1 o'clock. Yes, indeed. That's what happens. Welcome back to the second segment of Law Talk on a sultry Saturday afternoon. I'm Attorney John Matulis. That's the Bobby Fuller 4 theme song for the second half of our show here. This is the time in the show where it is my job to tell you that if you don't have an attorney and you're looking for some high quality, inexpensive legal advice, please consider the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. If you're a regular listener, you've heard this before, but if not, let me tell you how this works, because it is a good deal. You phone them at the phone number that I'm going to give you shortly, and they'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the specific nature of your legal inquiry. If you're calling about a criminal matter, you don't necessarily want to be referred to somebody whose primary interest is trusts and estates or medical malpractice or something of that nature. So they'll refer you to an attorney that practices in the proper discipline. And unlike what happens if you pick up the phone and call somebody whose billboards you see on Interstate 84 or on the internet or Craigslist or something like that, these attorneys are all vetted. Number one, they are experienced in the discipline to which you're being referred to them for. Number two, they are insured. And number three, they are free of disciplinary entanglements. Okay, so Mr. Attorney there, what comes down next? You got two questions. One of them, what's it cost and what do we get? Well, second question first. Here's what you get. You get a half-hour consult with the attorney. It can be in the attorney's office. It can be over the telephone. You can do it by Zoom or Teams or some other platform if you'd like. And after that, there's no hard sale. There's no push for further legal services. You're done. But if you'd like further legal services, you and the attorney are free to discuss that and decide whether you wish to work together or not. So that's how it works out. Second question first, what's it cost? Glad you asked. There is a one-time only fee of $35 that helps to underwrite some of the cost of operating this not-for-profit program. There is rent, there's salaries, there's phone expenses, there's admin expenses, so it's applied to that. And there's a couple of exceptions. If you are calling about your personal injury case, you've been injured, you're banged up, they will waive the $35 fee for you. You don't have one of those, but you're calling about a Social Security disability claim. Same thing. No fee for you either. The last category, workers' compensation. If you are calling about your workers' compensation claim, no $35 fee. So how do you access this service? I'm glad you asked. Pencils ready, folks. You call them at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. It is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. It's a good deal. It is a not-for-profit program. It's done as much as a public service as anything else. We recommend it highly. So that's 860-525-6052, the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Okay, back to Law Talk. We're here up until 1 o'clock, and then it's news, weather, and then pet talk. A veterinarian edition this week, Andrea Dennis. Dr. Andrea Dennis will be here, and she'll be delighted to speak with you about all matters pets, okay? Meanwhile, getting back to Law Talk, though, in the beginning of the program, we introduced some of our agenda, and now we're up to the legal rule of the day. What's the legal rule of the day? It's called the mailbox rule, okay? And we have a rather unusual case from the housing court in New Haven to introduce all of us to the mailbox rule. And this has a lot of importance for reasons that you're going to see shortly, okay? So this particular company, and because these are businesses, we'll use the names. We do not do that with personal injury or with personal cases with individuals. We simply use their first names. But the company called Corner Properties owns a building on Whitney Avenue in downtown New Haven. The rooftop of the building has been leased for some time to a company that puts billboards up at the various locations, okay? Initially, it was leased to Viacom Outdoor. At some point thereafter, it changed. The billboard stayed up because it was a long-term lease, but the new owner was somebody called Outfront Media. So Outfront Media is the new assignee under the lease for this rooftop, and the lease contains language that says that any notice has to be sent to the parties, and it gives the particular address, and then it says, or to such other address as they may specify in writing. So Outdoor takes over the billboard, and after a while, its property manager sends a letter to the building owner, Corner Properties, and says, we're the property manager, and we've moved from North Haven to the address below in New Haven, and that's where all communications should be sent, okay? And they send it first-class mail, and it's properly addressed. Didn't send it certified or anything else, sent it first-class mail. Now, those of you that are out there and are familiar with the mailbox rule, you're going to see where this is coming. So anyway, Corner Properties decides that they're going to terminate the lease. I guess there's an issue of non-payment of rent. So they send a written notice in the lease, as called for in the lease, that they're terminating it in about 6 months. And they gave them plenty of time, so it may not have had to do very much with non-payment of rent. And they send it to the property manager in North Haven, okay? Well, the tenant starts trying to renegotiate the lease. They bring the modest rent arrearage up current, but they're unable to reach an agreement. So now Corner Properties is doing an eviction. First thing they have to do is they have to serve a notice to quit. Well, this is a company that's located elsewhere, and the property manager is somewhere else, and the statute says you have to serve it at the location. Marshall goes up onto the roof and pastes the notice to quit onto the billboard. And as cumbersome as that may sound, that's exactly what was required under the statute. Didn't do any good, so now they have to file the summary process action in court, and this one gets served by the marshal on the parties themselves. Well, they file a motion to dismiss. The tenants say, no, you can't evict us. And the court says, well, why is that? Here's the answer. Because the lease requires you to send us notice of termination of the lease at the address specified or at any other address that we tell you in writing. And remember back when the property manager said in writing, hey, we've moved from North Haven to New Haven. And so you never sent them notice in New Haven. So that's the basis for it. And they have a hearing on this. And the landlord's representative says, well, I don't recall having seen any such notice and about sending it to you in New Haven instead of North Haven. And so here comes the rule. The mailbox rule basically says that a properly stamped and addressed letter that is placed in a mailbox or handed over to the U.S. Postal Service raises a rebuttable presumption that it was received. And on top of that, first-class mail enjoys a presumption of actual delivery, meaning that when it's placed in the mail, delivery is presumed and the sender need not confirm actual receipt. Okay? Now, those of you that have had any current experience with the U.S. Postal Service are probably laughing and saying, if ever there was a rule whose time came to be put to bed, this has got to be it. But it's still the rule. So the court says, well, when you, Mr. Landlord, when you went to terminate this lease and you sent the notice to the property manager, you sent it to the wrong address, you didn't comply with the requirement in the lease. Therefore, the termination is ineffective. So the eviction action was dismissed. Now, there's two points here. One of them is the mailbox rule. And the second point is if you have a commercial lease and the lease requires written notice of termination, as this one did, it still must be adhered to. It's not like a residential lease where it's not necessary because the notice to quit is the activity that terminates the residential lease. This one was a commercial lease and it contained the language requiring the notice. Notice got sent, didn't get sent in accordance with the lease. As far as the court's concerned, that's no notice at all. The eviction action was dismissed. We're going to have to take a break, but that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is the mailbox rule in all of its glory for whatever it is worth in 2024 U.S. of A. I'm attorney John Matulis. You're listening to Law Talk. It is WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Streaming audio on the net. Just punch it in and click on Listen Live and Odyssey Station. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk on a Saturday afternoon. I'm attorney John Matulis, and we're sort of easing into the last segment of Law Talk for today. Just wanted to let you know, you got a legal question, you got a legal comment. Delighted to hear from you at 860-522-9842. Happy to squeeze you in before the end of the show, should you like to give us a call. So we've got another carefully selected case. It's got lots of things to tell us about, and this one is just weird, okay? This involves a plaintiff named Salvatore and some defendants named Mark and Debbie, and this case comes out of the Milford Judicial District, okay? Salvatore is a friend of Mark and Debbie. He's also a licensed attorney. So he learns that Mark and Debbie are having a big problem financially. The problem is that they had personally guaranteed a student loan for somebody, probably a close relative, that the borrower hasn't paid, and now they're being sued for the balance on the loan, which is about $73,000. Salvatore says, I'll be happy to go over the papers. I'll look at it. I'll negotiate and see if we can't do better for you. And I'm doing all of this pro bono, which means for the shorthand for the good of the public. He means he's doing it for free. Okay. And so they say yes, and they're happy that he's doing that. A short while later, he reports back and he says, I've been able to negotiate the debt down to $32,000, providing you pay it by this Friday. And they say, well, thanks. That was a great piece of work. We don't have the money, but we think we're going to be coming into some money with the settlement of Mark's personal injury claim, and we should be able to deal with it, okay? So Sal says, I'll lend you the money. Now, remember, he is an attorney, and these are friends of his, but he's negotiated on their behalf with a third party. And so he does exactly that. And then the time comes for Sal to basically get repaid, and they say, well, we haven't got the money. And Sal, on his own, decides he's going to forgive the debt, and he does it in writing. And he gives them a piece of paper that basically says the debt is forgiven, absolutely, irrevocably and without any question whatsoever. And he finishes it with a brief Italian phrase in the end. Then Salvatore goes and sues them on the debt in an 8-count complaint. So this is just weird, and what is going on there? And there's a lot of different things to unpack in this one. And we're going to get to that shortly, but we've got a couple of people calling, and we always want to take care of our listeners. So that's what we're going to do right now. Let's go first to Rob in Merritt. And hi, Rob. Good to hear from you again. And tell us how we can help you. Rob, are you there? Let's try this again.
Yes, I am.
Okay, yeah. There we go. Yeah, we're having a little trouble with this audio console today. Tell us what we can do for you, Rob.
Wait, I just had a question. My son was involved in an accident in 2018, and he hit a car, rear-ended a car, and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the guy sues, and I think my policy maximum was $500,000. He wanted $750,000, so I got the money, dude, $500,000. So he settled it, and this was in May of 2023. So it's settled. He took the terms. Now, literally 3 days ago, some guy knocks on my door. I was home. My daughter's like, hey, what's up? And usually it's a sheriff giving you papers. It was some company called CSP. And he said he couldn't give it to her, but have him call me. So I call him up, assuming it's some type of sheriff. And he says, oh, this is from the guy who took the settlement. So he took the settlement for whatever money.
Yeah.
And he wants me to go to court to say that his insurance company took advantage of him. So
huh.
I call my insurance company up. They said, you shouldn't even talk to this guy. That thing's in your rear view mirror. That case is done and settled. Don't sign nothing. And they said, if you do, send it to their, it happens, I don't know if I can say the company, Safeco.
Okay.
And they said that, you know, you have no legal obligation to even talk to this guy unless I get compensated for going to court. But what information am I going to have? So I called the guy back and said, hey, will you compensate me for me making an appearance? That's not out of the question. And I'm like,
that's pretty definitive, so like, huh?
Yeah. So I said, well, give me something in writing. In the meantime, I'm sorry to be rude, but I was told that this is done with, and I gave him the date and everything. And I haven't heard back from him yet, but that was, have you ever heard of something like this?
No, that's really bizarre. So your son had this accident.
And he was on my policy.
It started to sound to me like this was a fight between the plaintiff and his underinsured motorist carrier. But it's
He was working for actually a company.
Yeah, the guy that showed up is probably from some sort of an outside claims adjustment firm or something like that. But they have no authority to serve process on you unless they're serving it as an indifferent person. And that's unusual in Connecticut for a number of different reasons. So this is a real head scratcher, Rob. I don't understand why they would.
What is CSP, though? Isn't it? Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt. Isn't it like usually a sheriff? Because I have Ben King, you know, while I was going through a divorce proceeding. A motion, the sheriff comes knocks on the door. Here, you gotta get. Yeah. It's like overpaid delivery guy, but this guy wasn't. No. It was called CSP, I believe. Well, I don't know what those acronyms mean. But must be a private. I don't know. But
Rob, might be good to take that to somebody at the lawyer referral service. For $35, they'll spend a half hour of time with you on it and help you figure it out. It sounds really bizarre, but can I give you that number? Because I got a call from Bill in Hartford to try to get you also.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
okay.
Give it to me, please. I got my pen.
Number is 860-525-6052.
Okay, thank you for picking up
the call. Okay, beautiful. And let us know in a future show how it turns out, okay? Thanks again.
I will.
Okay, real good. Okay, bye-bye now. Okay, our phone number is 860-522-9842. Next up, Bill in Hartford. Hey, Bill, you're on Law Talk. Tell us how we can help you.
Hi, just a quick question about your comments about the mailbox rule.
Yes, sir.
Usually, you know, in law, everything's proof. You got to have proof. I'm just wondering what kind of proof would the lesser have to show that actually showed that he put an envelope either in the post office or put it in the mailman's hand or whatever. I mean, how does that get proved?
His own testimony. It's a rebuttable presumption, and the key here is rebuttable. So if I take this envelope and it's properly properly addressed and it has the proper postage on it and I stick it in the mailbox, the law presumes that if I send it to Bill and it had the proper address for Bill and the proper postage, that Bill got it. Now, the Bill then has the right to rebut that presumption, and he can say, well, unfortunately, I didn't get it because the day before the house burned down and all the mail had been forwarded elsewhere and then it was abandoned or something of that nature, okay? So it's a rebuttable presumption. It was designed, as I understand it, initially for efficiency, so you didn't have to prove this stuff. But as someone who's had a lot of difficulty with the U.S. Postal Service lately, it sounds like it's a rule that really needs to be overhauled in light of all the present difficulties. But I hope that answers the question for you, Bill.
Yeah, well, it answers partially. But I guess my question is before the – I understand the presumption that if you mail it, it gets delivered.
Yep.
Does the court presume that if you say you mailed it, then you actually mailed it? That's I guess my question. How do you prove that when you say you mailed it, you actually mail it?
Sometimes people have a copy of what they've mailed out. In business, that's often the case where there's a copy that'll be dated. It'll be a true copy of what was sent out. Sometimes it's done in a larger business. It'll be a mail handling process by which it goes from somebody who generated it through a mail clerk or something of that nature. So that's basically it. Remember that anybody who's offering testimony in court is doing so under oath. And if it's untrue, that's perjury, which is a crime and which the judge can punish right on the spot anyway. So I hope that answers it a little better. But thank you for following up, because I think the mailbox rule is antiquated and needs some attention. And I'm glad you called.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Take care, Bill. Bye now. Okay, well, a couple of good calls at the end there, and that music is my cue to wrap up Law Talk. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar. Thank you for calling. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Kevin Kors, our engineer. And as we say in Law Talk, see ya.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors. We'll be right back.